Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is out this week doing her anti-war and pro-people duties. This episode of Black Agenda Radio is all about war, the one that President Obama claims he is not waging against the North African nation of Libya. Former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney knows it's a war because she's witnessed the bombing. And Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan says the United States is the last country on earth that should preach about what kind of government other people should have. But first, we'll hear from Bruce Fine, author of American Empire, Before the Fall. President Obama claims the War Powers Act doesn't apply to him because, well, he's not at war with Libya.
Well, it's rather a paradoxical statement because if it's not war, then the United States is committing murder in Libya. War is what makes what's customarily criminal homicide legal. So if we're not engaged in war, we're engaged in murder, which may be even worse. Moreover, it's a nonsensical statement. Even Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said that if another country launched a single Tomahawk missile into the United States, we would be at war. And if we just contemplated for a moment if any other country in conjunction with other nations or not was doing to us what we're doing to Libya, we would incinerate it with nuclear weapons. Moreover, one of the arguments that was made by President Obama and his minions is that because we are not having our soldiers on the ground and having the pilots immediately endangered and shot at by Libyans, therefore, this is not engagement in hostilities. And think about the ramifications of that analysis. It would suggest that if we launched nuclear missiles from the United States, ICBMs, and utterly destroyed and incinerated a country, it wouldn't be war because our own pilots and our own army wasn't endangered. That's obviously nonsensical, and it shows how we've been reduced to Orwellian language here in trying to justify an unconstitutional war through sheer sophistry.
Which tends to say that if the United States has developed full spectrum dominance that allows it to kill at will without being killed back, war will just continue ad infinitum.
Well, I think that's exactly accurate. That's the earmark of an empire. Empires seek to dominate for the sake of domination. It was John Quincy Adams, our Secretary of State and later president, who says the glory of a republic is freedom and liberty. The glory of an empire is domination and dominion. And we have now moved in the empire stage, and you're exactly right. We play by our rules of the game. Everybody else has to play by somebody else's rules, and namely the ones that we dictate, because we now authorize the use of predator drones invading any sovereignty anywhere in the world at any time if we say we suspect there's a single al-Qaeda or Taliban in your country. And any other country that did that to the United States, they say we would wipe them off the map. If they said, well, they think one of their dissidents or opponents is in the United States and therefore we're shooting missiles into the United States, it wouldn't take very long before they understood they would be retaliated against with warlike weaponry. So that's it. It's the arrogance of empire that has the quintessential double standards that earmarks the United States today. For example, we go around and we lecture other countries. You shouldn't be detaining people without accusation or charge. You just can't lock them up. And yet that's the definition of our detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Not accused of crime, not prosecuted for crime, just detained because we think they may be dangerous. It's the double standards that is the earmark of having crossed the Rubicon from a republic that celebrates liberty to an empire that celebrates domination and the swagger of a bully on a playground.
So if it's true that nobody can stop us but us, what is us, what are we to do?
It's only we have the ability still in legal architecture to call a halt to this ignoble base effort to dominate other peoples. It was like Abe Lincoln said, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. Our founding fathers, as we would not be colonized, so we do not want to be a colonizer. Our influence abroad is the influence of example, but we do not race to fight wars abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And only the people of the United States can revolt against the leadership here that is leading the country to ruination, both financially and with regard to our rule of law, and even with our safety, because we are creating more enemies than we are destroying with our arrogance. The Congress of the United States, and I've drafted an article of impeachment against President Obama, has the authority to remove any president who claims the unilateral power to go to war at whim, like this president has, although he's not the only one. I've also urged the impeachment of Bush and Cheney without result. But ultimately, entity, a nation is going to follow the trajectory of the popular will. And if the American people remain, as I think they are at present, indifferent and readily accepting of a vassalage status to an omnipotent president, we will get the same end of all other previous 72 empires, ruination.
It really is difficult to imagine a world that will simply tolerate the superpower acting as at its whim.
Well, that's exactly right. It may be for a while you can suppress the ability to retaliate, as we've seen was done in many Middle East countries. And then at some point, the pressure cooker can't stand the steam anymore, and it'll come back and haunt every empire, as it always has, whether it's the French Empire, Roman Empire, Ottoman Empire, Chinese Empire, British Empire. They all end up with a serial chronicle uprisings against the claim of the government to be everywhere, every time, every place, to suppress anyone who may be critical or objecting to the status quo. And it's a matter of time. The Roman Empire took a couple centuries to completely collapse, but our greatest enemy is the enemy within. We are destroying our own country. We are destroying our own values that gave us pride in being Americans, because we would honor due process. We would honor toleration and acceptance of people with different ideas and different perspectives, that we would not try to dominate by the gun or the bayonet, but to the extent we had influence, it was the influence of an example that was worthy of emulation. All those earmarks that signified a new birth, or the initial birth of freedom and popular government in 1776, has now gone out the window, and the government of the United States today vastly more resembles King George III of Great Britain 235 years ago than it does any republic.
Bruce Fine, author of American Empire Before the Fall. Francis Boyle is a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. He says President Obama didn't even attempt to make a convincing case for circumventing the War Powers Act.
Speaker of the House Boehner said that that argument doesn't even pass the straight face test. In other words, without breaking out laughing. I read the report that Obama sent to Congress. It's just an insult. There's one paragraph in there dealing with the legal explanation, and that's all it says. These really aren't hostilities. There's no legal argument, justification, nothing.
The president has sent out his apologists from the White House, who further elaborate on the position that he put forward and say that it's not a war because there aren't any troops on the ground.
But it doesn't matter, because the War Powers Resolution is triggered by the word hostilities, and of any type. And there is also another provision saying any time we are armed in the airspace of another state, the War Powers Resolution gets triggered. So there are two grounds. And then third, the U.S. Supreme Court already dealt with this issue in the prize cases, ruling that a blockade is an act of war. I successfully argued that in another case. So these are hostilities. This doesn't pass the straight face test. I take it you're referring to the article in today's New York Times, White House Counsel Bauer, who's nothing more but a legal hatchet man for the Democratic Party, and Harold Coe, the State Department legal advisor. Back in 1983, when Reagan invaded Grenada, I was leading the forces of opposition to the invasion of Grenada, and completely debunked their bogus argument for the legality of that invasion. Well, it turns out that Coe was working for Reagan at that time, in the Department of Justice, and he was the one who developed the legal argument to justify the invasion of Grenada that I debunked. It's just as bogus an argument today. So you have just two legal hatchet men, apparatchik, who get paid to go out there and defend whatever the president does. That's their job. It is a disgrace. You know, I would have thought at least Coe would have resigned rather than prostitute himself in this way. Bauer, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, even if it doesn't pass the legal laugh test, some politicians think they're building doctrines. Is there any doctrine that you can see behind all this?
By Obama?
Yes.
No, there are two presidents. President Truman realized he did not have a snowball chance in hell of getting a declaration of war to go to in Korea after World War II. So he ran through some Security Council resolution and used that as justification to go to war against Korea, and 36,000 American men died for absolutely nothing. And when the War Powers Resolution was drafted, it was drafted in part to deal with that terrible precedent to make sure it never happened again. Second precedent, of course, was Clinton bombing Serbia, led to the lawsuit Campbell v. Clinton. And Clinton had no authorization from anyone. But Clinton did stop after 78 days, which technically was before the maximum time limit of the War Powers Resolution, which is 90 days, which, as Congressman Boehner has pointed out to Obama, expires on Sunday. So even Clinton didn't go the full 90 days. Obama looks like he will. And then it's directly in the lap of Congress. Are they going to stand up and stop him, or aren't they? Clearly, we have impeachable offenses by Obama violating the War Powers Clause of the Constitution, the War Powers Resolution. In the lawsuit filed Wednesday, bipartisan members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, they also pointed out the violation of the Appropriations Clause of the Constitution, saying you can't spend money without appropriations by Congress. Boehner asked Obama to explain it. He didn't even bother. Where's the money coming from? It was just there was no accounting for it. And also the Anti-Deficiency Act, which is a felony, prohibiting switching accounts back and forth for unappropriated purposes. So you've got Obama on at least four impeachable offenses there. I've offered my services free of charge publicly to any member of Congress who wants to put in a bill of impeachment against Obama. So we'll just have to see what happens next week. I don't know. It's historically important because when Congress drafted the War Powers Resolution, they looked at all instances of presidential usurpation of the war powers to prevent it from happening again. And at the top of the list was Vietnam, but second on the list was Korea. And as we know, in Vietnam, 58,000 men of my generation were killed for nothing. And in Korea, 36,000 men of a previous generation were killed for nothing. And, of course, millions of Vietnamese and Koreans, too. So Congress already thought that they had plugged those loopholes. And the War Powers Resolution was passed over Nixon's veto, over two-thirds of both houses. And even the Obama administration admits it's constitutional. So you have the president in clear-cut defiance of the law and the Constitution. And the question is, what is Congress going to do about it? And more importantly, what are we, the American people, going to do about it? I think if you want to do something about it, contact your member of Congress and tell them that you want a bill of impeachment put in against Obama. That might get his attention and bring this war to a close before it gets worse. As we're seeing here, gradual escalation. We already have special forces on the ground. Everyone knows that. The British and the French have already put helicopters. Everyone's demanding more military from the United States, and I think that's the way we're moving towards some type of ground intervention. So it's a very serious situation. We have to stop this war now. And, of course, we're destroying Libya as a state and its people and its infrastructure. So we have to stop it now, and maybe if a bill of impeachment is put in there, that will get Obama's attention and wind this war down right away. I would hope so. But right now, I think he's calling Congress's bluff. To show you how bad it is, even Bush Jr. got authorization from Congress for his war against Iraq, which I opposed, by the way. Obama never even bothered with this. No authorization from Congress, no consultation, no nothing. He's just over there bombing on his own.
Professor of International Law Francis Boyle in Champaign, Illinois. Bill Quigley of the Center for Constitutional Rights finds President Obama's behavior disturbing.
This is a very, very peculiar position for the president to be in. The War Powers Act is a law that was passed after the Vietnam War by Congress saying, look, we just can't allow our country to just slowly get into wars, and then by the time we're into them and Congress has to fund them and our children have to be invested in these wars, but we never really had a discussion about it. It's never really been debated in Congress and that sort of stuff. So the Congress passed this War Powers Act, which is a very clear statement by the Congress that before the president moves armed forces into hostilities, that's the words in the law, into hostilities or into situations where there is imminent involvement in hostilities, that the president has to make a report to Congress and then within 60, in some cases 90 days, has to actually ask permission of Congress. It's been controversial in the past because other presidents have said, look, the president has the right to declare and to prosecute war under the Constitution, and that's not really up to Congress to decide. Congress can decide they're not going to give any money for it, and then it would shut down. But this is the first time, I think, other presidents have said, it's none of your business, and you can sue me if you want to. But for this president to say, I'm not saying it's none of your business, I'm not saying it's not a good law, I'm just saying it's not war or it's not hostilities, is very unusual. And again, I think it is part of the continuing building of what a lot of people call the imperial presidency, where the president gets to make decisions and the courts can't tell him what to do and Congress can't tell him what to do. And the people, you know, of course, if they don't have the courts or the Congress and there's no election that's imminent, they can't tell people what to do. And there's more and more accumulation of power in the president. That's gone on historically, but since 9/11, President Bush seized a lot of power, took a lot of power, challenged Congress for that. And if memory serves correctly to all of us, this is one of the things that the candidate Obama said, that we don't need to have an imperial presidency, and that the president, unusual position for this president to take, because it's entirely consistent with the accumulation of power by the presidents that we saw with President Bush and others. And it's very disappointing, and it's very disappointing that a lot of the scholars and other people in the State Department, Justice Department, and that, who were critical of the previous president's exercising war powers without consultation with Congress, those people are now justifying it. And this justification that it's not a war is, I mean, it's ludicrous. This is like the king wears no clothes. You know, I mean, they can say whatever they want to say, but when we see that not only have military people been subjected to war, but as we all know, a lot of civilians and others have been subjected to war in Libya, and there's a lot of people questioning why we have a war there, but to say the question whether we're at war there, I think, is literally, it's ludicrous. The problem is that what are you going to do about it? The Center for Constitutional Rights, of which I am a law professor at Loyola in New Orleans, but I'm also the associate legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. The Center for Constitutional Rights challenged the war in Central America. They challenged the first Iraq war under these similar kinds of challenges on behalf of a couple of Congress representatives. And people have asked us recently to challenge the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the war, the bombing of Yemen and the like. The courts are very cowardly. It's the cowardly lion. The courts are cowardly, and the courts say to the Congress representatives who say, look, the president's not doing the War Powers Act, they say, well, then, you know, show some guts and shut off the money. If you want to do that, you have a way to do that, and so you shouldn't bring the courts involved. So I don't expect that the lawsuit that was recently filed is going to be able to stop anything. That is a lawsuit filed on behalf of Democratic and Republican Congress representatives going to the court saying, you know, please make the president follow the law. I don't expect that's going to do anything. I honestly don't expect that either the Democrats or the Republicans are interested in provoking a showdown. There's a lot of posturing, and there's a lot of trying to play to the crowd. But I think the president is just saying, look, I'm going to do it. I think it's right, or I think it's appropriate, and I know you're not going to do anything about it. And I care so little about what you think that I'm even going to say that this is not a war. And for us to say, well, we're not at war because actually we're backing up NATO, I mean, our drones, our bombs, our planes, and whether they're not directly our planes, are often planes that we have sold to the other NATO people, and we maintain, we do all this other stuff. It's just, I think, the Wizard of Oz land where we're talking about this is not a war, so we don't have to go through it.
The White House has its defenders going around saying that it's not a war because there are no U.S. boots on the ground and no Americans are being killed. So I guess it's not a war even if foreigners are being killed.
The president and his defenders have been saying that it's not a war because soldiers are not involved. But that, again, follows through on some of the very worst parts about being in the United States, which is that we define people as our people, people in the United States. And we don't find everybody in the United States as people, obviously. The people who we say don't have the right papers, they're not people. The people who are in jail, they're not entitled to be treated as people. And people outside the United States, people in Libya, whether they're civilians or military, clearly are not people for our concerns. The same sort of thing. You know, when we're using the drones in Yemen, we're using drones in Pakistan, we're firing drones all over the place. If our people don't get killed, then nobody gets killed. The United States has never kept track of official track of civilians dying in Iraq or Afghanistan. They're not people. They don't count from this perspective that the United States is exceptional and our people are somehow very different. So it's a tragic but ludicrous, in a sense, tragic and ludicrous extension of this thing that the president gets to make all the rules and nobody else has to follow the rules. The question I always ask is things going back to kindergarten. We all know the golden rule. So I always think that the first thing we say is that, okay, if this rule is good enough for us, would it be good enough for them? Would we think if Libya was launching drones into the United States, or Libya and a couple of other countries were working together to bomb and strafe and kill people in the United States, would we say that's not a war because maybe there's no Libyan soldiers on the ground in the United States? That's ludicrous. And if it's ludicrous when it's applied to us, it's ludicrous when we are doing the same thing. And I think it's just another effort by the people in power in the United States to just do what they want and challenge people to really care or to even make a rational response. It violates international human rights law. We're violating our own law, and it'll be interesting to see whether anybody really gives a damn.
Another insidious explanation for why this is not war is that since it is U.S. foreign policy to somehow get rid of Colonel Gaddafi, then this is consistent. The drones, the assistance to the Europeans, all this is consistent with declared U.S. foreign policy and therefore not a war.
you know, the defense that because it's foreign policy, it's consistent with our foreign policy, it's not a war, is even emptier as a defense than the idea that it's not a war because it's not a war, or because we don't have boots on the ground, because we have a policy of opposition to a lot of countries in the world, and that's a policy. That's a political position that we take, and our political positions are debated. They're talked about. There's money involved. There's placement of State Department people on that, but war and the destruction of human life is a different matter. It literally is life and death differences, what we're talking about, not only for our people, but for the people who are feeling the effects of the, you know, the war-making superpower that the United States is in the world right now. And I think that the White House and their defenders are just figuring that people just don't really care because the excuses that they're giving are so lame. They're hoping that they can, that all this will just pass them by. But it is another expansion of destructive power by the United States. And I would never vote for it, but the president taking the position that neither Republicans nor Democrats even have to vote for it, it's just up to the president to decide who to bomb and when to bomb, is another extension of this imperial presidency. The president has already claimed that has the right, unilateral right, unchecked by Congress or the courts, to execute United States citizens any place in the world that they think that they might be involved in so-called terrorist activities. Now the president has taken the position that we can bomb people any place in the world and that they don't need to have approval of Congress or the courts. This is just, we are acting literally like the neighborhood bully who just will do whatever they can get away with, and they'll call it whatever they want to call it, but it comes down to the fact that they feel like doing it and they think they're big enough to get away with it, and so they're going to do it. And that's unfortunately exactly what this president is engaged in at this minute.
Bill Quigley speaking from New Orleans. Opponents of the war on Libya held a press conference near United Nations headquarters in New York. The event included remarks Skyped in from Cynthia McKinney, the former Georgia congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate who was still in Libya on a fact-finding mission. Cynthia McKinney is part of a national speaking tour on the war against Libya, beginning Saturday, June 25th in Harlem. Viola Plummer of the December 12th movement told the press conference the U.S. and Europe are out to recolonize Africa.
Good afternoon, and again we come to draw attention to the imperialist aggression in our homeland, Africa, it is very clear to us that what's afoot if we go back to Brzezinski's chessboard, that Africa at this point is the focal point for the empire's recolonization. There are two extremely important countries on the continent of Africa at this point. One such is the sovereign country of Libya, and that it is very clear that the bombing, the aggression, the attempt at the murderous assassination of a leader sits well with the government of the United States. We are calling on African people throughout the United States, and I say African people in particular, because it is Africa. It is Africa which is at this time in the crosshairs. The attempted assassination of President Muammar Gaddafi and the illegal sanctions on the Republic of Zimbabwe. These two countries are the stalwart countries who resist the militarization of the continent vis-a-vis Africa. So that we are calling on people throughout the United States to join us August 17th, August 13th, I'm sorry, here in Harlem, where we are calling millions of our people to understand our relationship between here and Africa, between the United States and Africa, that we are under attack, and that we must mobilize the millions of our people, because we are clear from the teachings of Dr. John Henry Clark that it must be Pan-Africanism or we perish.
Former U.S. Attorney General and veteran anti-war activist Ramsey Clark was also on hand in New York to denounce U.S. war policies.
The crime of the moment is the murderous assault by the United States, the United Nations, and NATO on the people of Libya. Last in a long line of assaults on Arab and Muslim peoples. 20 years now, the cradle of civilization, Iraq, has been systematically attacked and destroyed under the leadership of my country, the United States. We see a long struggle in Afghanistan. We see drones invading the sovereignty of Pakistan and threatening to invade the sovereignty of Yemen. There's no end to it. The United States has supported dictators over the Arab people for years and years. We supported Mubarak to the very end, in spite of the patent, massive revolution of the people, finally, after suffering under Sadat and Mubarak, because of the United States backing there. And it has to end. We tried to assassinate the leader of the Libyan people in 1986. It was a sneak attack. Planes from Lackenheath Air Force Base in England, flying all the way around the Iberian Peninsula and coming through the Straits of Gibraltar, coming right off the sea. And what did they hit first? They hit the compound we're seeing every day on television. They hit his office. They hit his tent out in the compound there. They hit his home. They killed a daughter. This time they've killed three grandchildren. Is there no end to it? Is there no decency? Are the people of the planet powerless to end such tyranny and violence? It's absolutely essential that we stand up, that this institution across the street that was created to end the scourge of war, stop initiating and supporting the scourge of war for superpowers like the United States. Assassinations are something we know about too. There were three in my time in the Department of Justice. everyone heartbreaking of a great moral leader. And it has to stop. It needs to stop right now. We need to call a cessation of the arms fight, peace settlement of any dispute that exists there. But the support of the people for Colonel Gaddafi seems pretty obvious. They've been able to withstand this enormous assault from outside by the greatest powers on earth that manufacture too many arms. And the United States must cut its military spending by 90% before there can be peace on earth, because that is the problem, all those arms coming out of this country. Thank you.
Former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. The featured speaker last week was Minister Louis Farrakhan. The leader of the Nation of Islam took on the United Nations directly.
I'm addressing my remarks to the United Nations and all those who have joined to destroy brother leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and the Libyan Jamahiriya. What is the justification for such an action that was taken by the Security Council of the United Nations? If the Security Council passed Resolution 1973 to protect the civilian population of Libya from the so-called evil intentions of the leader of Libya, why then is NATO, under the auspices of the Security Council, forgetting about humanitarian concerns and now using Resolution 1973 as a pretext to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi and create regime change? Why is the UN fostering, through NATO, armed rebellion to create civil war, knowing that in a civil war, the humanitarian concerns go out the window? Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said, "Gaddafi's days are numbered. We are working to plan for the inevitable, a post-Gaddafi Libya." Russia says, "Gaddafi has lost the moral right to lead Libya after attacking his own people." The actions of NATO, along with the United States, Canada, Qatar, and members of the Arab League, engaging in this errant behavior, are creating conditions that will ultimately bring about the destruction of the United Nations and all those engaged in this action. Blinded by arrogance and the sense of power of these nations that they can do what they will, they cannot fathom the consequences of their actions. They think they are on a good course in which all of the vultures will benefit. But in the end, all of you will see that you have signed on to that which will ultimately bring about your utter destruction. What has Muammar Gaddafi done to deserve what this united coalition of demons is putting on him? They say that he has lost the moral right because he has killed his own people. But you have never proved that charge. Check the record of America, England, France, Canada, Qatar, Italy, the Arab League, and put it up against the record of Muammar Gaddafi and the Libyan Jamahiriya. England, France, Italy, Germany, and the United States do not have a good humanitarian record. America, with the transatlantic slave trade and 450 years of evil toward the blacks, the decimation of the Indian population, and the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That record is clear. England and all of your empire, you have never had humanitarian concerns for the people of Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, and other places that you ruled. So are you better now than what you once were? I suggest not. What are the real strategic interests that compel you to this behavior? Libya, under Muammar Gaddafi, pushed the British and the Americans out of Libya, closed their bases, and nationalized its oil. That angered Western powers, even as Mohammad Mossadegh of Iran angered the West when he nationalized Iranian oil. That action led to a CIA operation that planted the Shah on the throne as the ruler of Iran. Under his rule, the people of Iran lost much of their Islamic identity, giving birth to Imam Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranian Islamic Revolution. Whatever you, England, France, Italy, Germany, and America, whenever you planted leaders, they were always those who put their personal wealth and gain over the best interests of their people. Thus, whenever you installed a dictator, whether it is in the Caribbean, Central America, South America, Asia, Africa, or the Middle East, you always knew that the legitimate interests of the people would cause some of the people to rise against that dictator. So your dictator had to use methods of repression, torture, and destruction of life to preserve your dictator and to preserve your economic and strategic interests in that country. Have you changed? Are you better than your predecessors? I think not. So when a man like Muammar Gaddafi rises in a bloodless coup and replaces the former king, who was a friend of those who were sucking the blood of Libya, and nationalizes oil, we must ask the question, who did his actions help and who did his actions hurt? It hurt those who were for the first time had to pay a fair price for Libyan sweet crude, the sweetest high quality oil in the world, which meant that the people of Libya could, from the sale of their oil, better their quality of life. How did Muammar Gaddafi use the riches of Libya? He loves to put a tent in the desert, so you cannot say he used oil money, as some of your other friends, just to build huge palaces. Nor can you say, no matter how much wealth he has, that he does not consider the Libyan population. Were you displeased with his use of Libyan oil money to take down dictators that England, France, America, Italy, and Germany put in place? Yes, you were angry with him. So he became number one on the list of the West to be destroyed. You say he did the Lockerbie bombing, the bombing of a discotheque in Berlin. Well, none of us who are sane and civilized can cotton to any kind of action that destroys the lives of Libyan people or innocent people. Does that compare in any way, however, with America, England, France, Germany, Italy, with your record of mass murder against regimes that you didn't like? Let's look at President Sukarno in Indonesia. He was a man who called all African and Asian nations and nations of color together in the Bandung Conference of 1955 to discuss the wickedness of the West against the poorer and weaker nations of the earth. How many hundreds and thousands of lives were lost when Sukarno was overthrown in a CIA-sponsored coup? Estimates range from between 250,000 to 500,000 deaths. Have you changed? Or are you the same as you were, but dressed in different garments? Assassination plots against Fidel Castro, Patrice Lumumba, Papadoc Duvalier of Haiti. Are you a new and better France, a new and better England, a new and better Germany, a new and better Italy, and a new and better America? That you could sentence another man to death with your history written in the blood of black, brown, red, yellow, and the blood of your own Caucasian people? This is why the Bible calls you the blood shedder. Have you changed? You have shed the blood of all life without just cause. Are you the protector of the humanitarian rights of the Libyan people with the records? Have you changed? Are you better than you were? Let us see. if Muammar Gaddafi has lost his moral right to lead the Libyan people, let us see what is going on in your countries and ask you the same question. What is your humanitarian record with your own citizens? You great imperial powers. Europe's unemployment right now is at a 12-year high. Unemployment in France is near 10%. Italy and England are near 8%, and Britain has lost close to 1 million youth out of work. Spain has 21% unemployment. That's 5 million jobless. And what about crime? Britain's violent crime record is worse than any other country in the European Union. The UN itself found that the crime rate in England is worse than in America, and both make the crime rate in Libya look almost non-existent. Libya ranks 61 in the world in their incarceration rate. Russia is number 2. The United States of America is number 1. Can you lecture Muammar Gaddafi and call him a madman? Can you lecture Muammar Gaddafi and call him a madman? When if the leader of a country is mad, would not that be reflected in the citizens of that country? In the crime of rape, Sweden, Britain, Belgium, Norway, Israel, Denmark, Spain, France, Russia, Canada, Japan, and Germany all lead Libya. If he has lost the moral right to lead his people, what about you? What about homelessness? The rate in Britain is nearing 8%. In France, they estimate that 200,000 people live on the streets. In America, there are nearly 1 million living under bridges, homeless. We save America for last because America started all this. You are the one that called for such action. And you maneuvered this resolution 1973 through the Security Council and fought for it and were the proudest when it passed. You are the one that called for Gaddafi to step down and leave his country, and you are the first to say that he has lost the moral right to lead Libya, and you are the first to call for his assassination. Well, America, you are hemorrhaging jobs. Nearly 8 million jobs were lost in this latest recession. America now has 15 million unemployed, and when you add to that the underemployed, it comes to nearly 20 million Americans. 44 million Americans now live below the poverty level, and that is rising. A full one-third of American families tasted poverty for at least a couple of months last year. That's 100 million Americans. And the number of households collecting emergency food aid is now nearing 6 million. Approximately 1 in 8 million, 8 American people are using food stamps. 3 million U.S. properties went into foreclosure in 2010 alone, a record high. And the number of families in homeless shelters or forced to live with extended family or friends is nearing 1 million. 50 million Americans have no health insurance, and that's 17% of the total U.S. population. 68 adults in America die each day in the U.S. due to the lack of health insurance. And what about your veterans, America? Those whom you send to fight your unjust wars. How do they fare when they return home? The Pentagon says that 1 in 5 American soldiers are returning from the war zones with some form of traumatic brain injury. Still others suffer emotional trauma. About 130,000 veterans become homeless each year in the United States, and more than half are black and Hispanic. The Veterans Administration estimates that 107,000 veterans are homeless on any given night. Suicide rates, divorce, and drug dependency are alarmingly high and worsening among America's veterans. Your infrastructure is even worse off than your citizens. A full one quarter of the nation's bridges are structurally dangerous. 7 billion gallons of clean water leak out of your crumbling pipes every day, while billions of gallons of raw sewage pours into your lakes and rivers. According to your engineers, it will take $2.2 trillion to fix this problem. Your record, America, stinks in the nostrils of God. You who, in the name of humanitarian efforts, want to save the population of Libya, save them from whom and from what? How many Libyans are living in poverty? What's the crime rate in Libyan society in comparison to you who condemn Muammar Gaddafi? How many homes has he built for his people? How many of his people are living under bridges? No Libyan lives in poverty, not one. The crime rate in Libyan society is nothing in comparison to those of you who condemn him and his rule of Libya. He has built hundreds of thousands and into the millions of homes for his people. No Libyan is homeless. No Libyan is living under a bridge. Why are you angry with him? What has he done to bring down on him the wrath of the West? Why do you hate Gaddafi? Does he share the wealth of Libya with the poor? Well, if he does, and he does, doesn't that make you, America, look bad? You are the richest nation on the earth, and you've got 44 million people living in poverty, bread lines, food stamps, children suffering in America, but you want to talk to Gaddafi about humanitarian concerns? Gaddafi believes that economic democracy can only be achieved when the GDP of a country benefits all its citizens and when the country's wealth is dispersed to every single citizen. One journalist who lived in Libya wrote of the accomplishments Libya has made under the leadership of Muammar Gaddafi. This journalist is Brother Gerald A. Pereira from Guyana. Listen to what he says and see if you can defeat the truth of what he has said. Number one, Gaddafi nationalized Libya's vast oil resources and used his influence within OPEC to negotiate fairer prices for oil-producing countries. Two, Gaddafi used the oil revenue to build schools, hospitals, universities, and infrastructure. Three, he raised the literacy rate from 20% when he became the leader, and now it is 83%. Libya has one of the finest healthcare systems in the third world. All people have access to doctors, hospitals, clinics, and medicines free of charge. If a Libyan needs surgery that is unavailable in Libya, funding is provided for that surgery to be carried out overseas. He raised the life expectancy from 44 years now to 75. Basic food items were subsidized and electricity was made available throughout the country. He spent billions on the man-made river, where he brought, his engineers brought water up out of the desert. And now pipelines run from Benghazi and Tobruk almost to the door of Tunisia. This man has set up irrigation projects which were established in order to support a drive toward agricultural development and food self-sufficiency. Any Libyan who wanted to become a farmer was and still is given free use of land, a house, farm equipment, livestock, and seed. Gaddafi vowed that his own parents, who lived in a tent in the desert, would not be housed until every Libyan was housed. He fulfilled that promise. Under Gaddafi, Libya has now attained the highest standard of living in Africa. Listen to this. Money from Libya's oil revenue is deposited into the bank account of every Libyan. Women have full access to education, employment, and he has enabled women to serve in the armed forces. This is most important. Gaddafi was the first and only leader in the Arab world to formally apologize for the Arab role in the trade in captured Africans. Gaddafi acknowledged that the black Africans were the true owners of Libya and proclaimed in his Green Book, the black race shall prevail throughout the world. Pereira writes, imperialists fear a united Africa which would completely alter the balance of power globally. The well-documented fact is that if Africa stopped the flow of all resources and raw materials to the Western nations for just 1 week, the United States and Europe would grind to a halt.
Minister Farrakhan said the United Nations itself has lost legitimacy by serving the purposes of the powerful. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Matt Bogart.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.